I don't really do these intros, but I felt like I need to for this one because it's a lit. I remember being a lot of fun, but also a lot of chaos. And it's basically me just hanging out with the artist Robert Pasternak, who lives in Winnipeg. When I visited Winnipeg to do some research on Canadian underground comics, I decided to do a couple interviews while I was there, and everyone said I should meet Robert, and I'm really glad I did. I visited him in his charming little home, where we started the visit by a mural he did on his garage in his backyard of a memory of what a sign looked like on the side of a corner store. And from there, we kind of dove in and went into a studio. His studio is like two different rooms on the top floor of his house. One side is his more specific cartooning studio where he creates his objects and works in fine detail. And the other side of the top floor of the house is his more painting studio, or more abstract work. And so it's definitely, he's working with both sides of his brain and really constructive, creative, fascinating stuff. And I'm really glad I got the chance to visit him in a studio and look at all he had there and kind of experience in such a fun way. I really enjoyed talking to Robert, and it was one of those conversations where I had to immediately press record because he's just chatting and he's saying all sorts of interesting stuff, and we got to get it on record. So I don't think we did a proper intro. I can't remember. I'm recording this, you know, 6 months after the actual interview. So enjoy it as you will. It's, like I said, a little chaos, a little fun, but one of a kind.
Stop you.
Yeah, okay.
let's sit, because I can tell you're up for chatting.
Well, no, it's just, you know, the stories, if there are stories.
Yeah.
But I do, okay, anyways. Oh, I mean, I've got the books.
You know, I've got the recorder going, so why don't we just start?
Yeah.
And so the Steranko Show, how old were you when that?
14. Was I 15 yet? 63? No, I wasn't 15 yet, so I was, 14 years old. And it was, it really got me into, you know, thinking about comics more. You know, obviously I had an interest in it, I guess, through just, you know, various little things previously, you know, comic book here or there that ran through the house, and my older brother Gary, you know, drawing or copying things, and then me in tow sort of copying things from some of the comic books, like not Brand Eck, I remember one being around, and Captain America with bullet holes.
What kind of stuff was in the Steranko Show?
Well, S.H.I.E.L.D., the Hulk, the original...
Oh, okay.
Smash. Hulk. Yeah. A lot of S.H.I.E.L.D. original art, and then, you know, the printed pages, printed comics. I mean, the covers, rather, yeah. Printed covers. What else? Jeez, I wish there was photos from it, because, you know, it's all just kind of a sort of this vague thing now, right? I mean, I was just a kid, so.
But in terms of breakthrough art shows, I mean, that was an early one for a lot of different ways, not just for yourself, but the doing a institutional art show in comics in Canada.
No, totally, and it sort of you know, it shone a spotlight in Steranko, and then, you know, in my mind, so then I was looking for comics, for Steranko comics, and then that influenced me in certain ways in doing art, you know, the fine art, not so, you know, maybe comics, but I don't know really. Like, my influences come from so many different kinds of art that it's often hard to pinpoint, you know. Like earlier influences aside from Steranko, you know, Alex Nino. Because okay. I was doing more pen and ink stuff before I was doing comics.
Yeah, know? Well, Nino's neat because he had such like a dynamicism to his work that is so different from all the other stuff. And so it's like there's a weird, like, I almost want to say expressionistic thing to the way his figures moved.
Yeah.
elongate and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's interesting to find out later that he became sort of a Disney artist and doing a lot of art and storyboard stuff and background design stuff. And that stuff is just so expressive as well.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's great. There's a lot of work he's done for Disney. Oh, geez, what was that one movie? I don't know. I don't see most of them anyways. Anyways, but yeah, the Winnipeg Art Gallery then had a lot of these other local artists, like seasoned artists. Well, in my mind, they were, because they're, you know, older than I was at the time, that, you know, still resonate with me to this day, you know. You know, Don Proche and Ivan Eyre and Marcia Whitten, Esther Warkov. You know, I don't know if you know any of any of these, but I mean, they just all, they're all different, and they, but they've all given me pieces. But then, you know, and then you fuse that with Frazetta and, you know, Steranko. Like after this, I started collecting comics more. And at that time, you know, Kirby was sort of in full force with Devil Dinosaur and,
I think issue 6 of 2001 is, for me, is like one of the greatest comic book singular issues.
You know, Eternals, there was Black Panther, there was, what was the other one, other main one? You know, then I got into Micronauts, that's something else, and Michael Golden stuff. Anyways, yeah, it was sort of a portal, you know, that sort of took me into that realm. And then I did start doing some comics, and I did some comics with Ron White, and we put out this book called Return from Jolt, which was a collection of art and some comics. That was like 1985. And then somehow it was through Doug Salipa's Comic World. He was heading to the Chicago Comic Con, and somehow I got a table there for Return from Jolt, and you know, met some other cartoonists there. One of them was Jeff Gaither. He said, "Oh, you should do a mini comic for me," which I ended up doing in '86, called Holy Crow, and then that started this whole other thing of mini comics, because I was introduced to mini comics. And I started doing a whole bunch of mini comics for Clay Gertie's Comics.
Oh, okay.
I was doing the Acid Man Society, and I did like 18 issues through a few years there. And then I just started doing them myself, or I started to thinking, I just started to think, you know, how else can I make a comic? How else can I, you know, put my art in a form that's not necessarily a mini comic or a book? So I started experimenting with, you know, candy packaging, and the first sort of novelty comic was like Wrigley's Gum. It wasn't a comic. It was just an issue of Acid, because all the Acid Man issues aren't all just comics. Yeah. It sort of became, you know, comics and art and thoughts and, you know, ideas. And but so, yeah, the first issue, first novelty issue was a little stick of gum. Like, that's what it looked like. But then you unwrapped it, took the foil out, and you had a little book instead of the stick of gum. Yeah. So that, okay, then what can I do next? What else can I do? How else can I
push yourself?
Yeah. So I could show you quite a number of those these novels.
Well, why don't we sit down? Because I'm holding a microphone, and
okay,
I'm weak armed, spaghetti noodle arms.
We'll sit on the other side. These are some books here. I'll just bring these in the other room. You could sit in a red chair there.
Sure.
I could put all this stuff here. Let's get these pencils out of the way. This is the book that Nick edited.
Place
and helped
being.
Put together.
Yeah, this, like, he told me that the PDF that he sent me, it is nowhere near the actual printed book
is.
Yeah, it's
and
not...
He's really, like, I can see just... I don't think I was expecting it to be published at this size. Like, this is... Bit, 8.5 by 14, or it's a little wider than 8.5.
It's eight. It's actually 8.5 by 12.
I okay. Think.
8.5 by 12. It's a bit bigger than 8.5 by 11. Yeah,
8.5 by 12.
There
we go.
Yeah, it just feels so beautiful. The paper's so nice and soft, and
yeah.
The printing is great, and it turned out really
gorgeous.
Well. It turned out really well.
So. There's a lot to talk about. You're doing mini comics all the way to this, which I would best describe as kind of, I'm not going to say abstract because you actually have some really specific things you're doing with it, but it's definitely not straight linear.
Yeah, they're all over the place. Some of them are, like the way Nick put this book together, the earlier ones have more of a linear narrative, and then they get jazzier as we go along, and you know, to the point where, you know, is this even a comic?
Yeah.
You know, anymore.
Some stuff very specifically, I would say it's still it all is comics. It's
the stuff I'm doing now. I'm starting to wonder, should I just call it art and stop calling them comics? I don't know anymore. I've gone so far in that direction.
Well, it's beautiful. It's also interesting. Like, it's poetry. This book, like, it's very much almost a concrete poetry.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree for sure. There's just little sonnets, what's the other Japanese
haikus.
Phrase? Haikus, yes.
Yeah. Have you ever looked at the work of B.P. Nichol?
Yes. But wait a minute, why? Okay, but it's escaping me, but yeah, the name is there.
He was a poet and kind of minimalist cartoonist, and he did a thing called Captain Poetry, and would do like really loose kind of characters and figures and motion and stuff, just really interesting.
Okay,
it was about
okay.
mid-70s. Snore Comics was an anthology.
Yeah, see, I would have seen some because yeah, the name is so familiar, but I don't have any examples of his stuff.
I'm always curious of, you know, like part of this project of getting to know Canadian comics is to see where things are regional and where things aren't.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Here we are in Winnipeg, and from where I'm seeing regionalness here. It's really fascinating because you have different regional strains here where you've got, I think there's a part where you're in where the mini comics and some of that like 80s alternative and then changing. And I wouldn't say you're alternative, like looking at the mini comics. Frank McTruck had some of your mini comics.
Oh, okay.
When I was over at his place the other day. And, I could see early on that you weren't kind of going with what the norm was.
No. What was I doing back there? Jeez, back then. You know, visually I could see it, but where was it coming from? In the mid-80s there, I mean, there was... What was I looking at?
You mentioned Raw in...
Oh, yeah, yeah,
in this
yeah,
book.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I'm unfolding a giant comic strip meanwhile, and it's just a whole slew of different three-panel pseudo-gag strips.
Yeah, yeah.
That are... all different.
Yeah, grab one end here.
Okay, we're gonna unfold this thing.
because there's the other side as well. So it's just this, ends up being this large poster.
Gag strips. Okay. So tell me about Meanwhile. What does Meanwhile mean to you?
It's sort of, Meanwhile, to me, it's sort of like this bridge going from, you know, you're in one scene and then, you know, there's this gap in between, Meanwhile, and then something else is happening.
It's a lot of non sequitur.
Yeah. So these are sort of, these to me are sort of like mostly three act plays almost.
Yeah.
Where there's, you know, somewhat gags. You know, you got to figure it out a little bit. So it was just, it was one of the things I started to do when I sort of left the art world in 2012 or so, and I had to get a job, and that job allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do with my art.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to make abstract comics. And just the idea, because I love abstract art, like I said earlier, you know, influences come from so many different art sources and people. I love so much of it. See, you know, I feel so much of it.
Yeah.
One of the things is abstract art that I really seem to like and gravitate towards. And so I thought, you know, how can I make comics and abstract art together? So every time I sat down at the table, I just have these, you know, what all is comics? What all is abstract art? And sort of like this atom smasher, just throwing these two particles together and just see what happens.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, and it was different every time. Yeah. I'd get like a different result because I'm picking something out from abstract art and picking something out from comics. But I'm not thinking what those things are though.
Yeah.
Because it's again, you know, just like the mural outside that we saw, you know, just this you know, it's always way more interesting to draw from your memory of something than from a photograph or something that you've recorded, you know, because it's just, it's going to be like it, but it's not going to be it. You're not copying anything now.
Yeah.
Because, and depending on how much time has passed, that image changes or that memory changes of it, right? Which then just extrapolates something else out of that.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm not looking at anybody's work.
Are you, like, it's interesting, so like,
but there's a lot of everyone's work in my head.
There's something happening there that's both evolving in the artwork but also devolving. Do you know what I mean by that? Where you're creating an image and you're also pulling the image apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this like idea where you're trying to find that essence.
And the interesting with the essence thing, because what happens at first in creating these things, there's sort of like a light switch going on and off, where I'm thinking about what I'm doing and I'm not thinking about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And this constant flickering back and forth, because I don't want to know exactly what I'm doing, you know, because I don't want there to be that influence.
Yeah.
But
well, it's sorry, I don't mean to I'm really into this. What I think about when you're doing that, the light flashing on and off, is also looking at your work and thinking about the concept of like how watching something in strobe lights works.
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting every motion.
Yeah.
You're getting each beat.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I never thought of it that way with the on-off thing, but yeah. So I'm just, you know, being conscious, being not conscious, you yeah. know, of what I'm doing. Like, I want there to be that narrative, but I want it to be abstract, right? I yeah. mean, it's abstract art isn't supposed to have anything, you know, objective in there, right? I mean, you're supposed to just see whatever you see, or just not even see, but to feel, because you're no longer really looking at anything.
Yeah,
you know, you're absorbing it.
It's the space for the artist to provide the viewer with something to take time with,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
find mm-hmm. what they want in the art.
And that happens. That happens. It's interesting, you know, how different it is from
yeah.
person to person. You know, so that's really cool. It's not set in stone of what's happening
no.
here. It's interesting with the graphic novel that's in front of you here,
Fast Forward.
How it's wordless.
Yeah.
There is a narrative, there is something going on. But
and this is published in France or Quebec?
In Quebec. Yeah. And it's interesting again, because how much will people actually pick up? The
yeah.
publisher picked up on what was going on, which is really, really, really neat. Without me mentioning anything at all.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. But then there was also other things that, oh, I didn't know this was going in there, or I didn't know this was happening. So there's that bit of that as well.
What does symmetry mean to you?
Interesting, because I have this whole other body of work called Metafigures.
Yeah.
And they're all, there's this symmetry, these figures that, you know, you could draw this line down the middle. It's not perfectly symmetrical, because I'm not, you know, using mirrors or computers to duplicate sides.
Yeah.
So there's these variations, but that symmetry to me is a grounding.
Yeah.
It's a stillness.
Yeah.
You know, it's just sort of being.
Yeah.
Where there's this flow from the center, you know, going this way, going that way, going, you know, I mean, it's, that's kind of what it is, sort of this balance,
yeah.
you know, and this sort of just perfect stillness or perfect being, and just, it's not moving. Usually, you know, something so symmetrical, it seems still, because it's not motion, you're not seeing, you know, it in an angular fashion of in dimensions in that way.
Well, it's also interesting, because you talk about the perfection, but it's also the imperfections of it not being computerized and not being mirrored that keeps it human.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Because when you do things on the computer symmetrical, it seems generated or something,
yeah.
you know? So I hugely admire the pinstriping guys.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know? Because, you know, with the brushes that they use and the flow of the paint, how they're able to just mimic. I mean, I could do that to a degree, but it's not like what they do. I could fix up things, you know. I mean, they can too, I'm sure, you know.
Like,
but
when you see a sign painter doing those letters with that one pen and...
Yeah.
Or brush pen
yeah,
or brush
yeah, yeah.
and it changes dimension and changes width and impact. It's just fascinating, and it's like watching water.
It totally is. And there's the use of that material, right? Like, you have to know how that paint is flowing, how that ink is flowing, and what that brush does. There's so many young graphic designers that, you know, so many of the fonts, early lettering and fonts, are derived by that technique of the tools being used. They look a certain way because of the kind of brush that's used. You know,
yeah.
like Roman letters look a certain way because that's the shape of the chisel, you know, stuff yeah. like that, right?
Yeah.
I remember at one point early, I was working at a cresting place. They did like chenille crests, right? And there's this lettering called brush script. You know, it's called brush script because it was, you know, letters made by a brush.
Yeah.
But, you know, not knowing that specifically, you sort of think it looks like it's sort of brushy. But having to sort of mimic that lettering without, this is before computers.
Right? Yeah.
You know, there was typesetting, but it's before computers. Having to mimic that lettering by just drawing, like you had to draw, you know, champions, right? Yeah. In that style and not really understanding why it looks
yeah.
that way. It's just the style. So the other guy I was working with was always like correcting me and stuff. And, you know, it wasn't until later on you realize, okay, it has the ends look like this because, you know,
it's that's how the hand
would flow. You know, and the thick and thin of the line and stuff. Yeah, this was ages ago. This was like 1980 or so.
Yeah.
So all that, you know, I mean, I use that kind of, you know, I'm sure a lot of artists do, you know, think about that kind of stuff when they're doing art, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when the stuff that I'm doing now, I'm thinking, you know, when I come to the easel or the drawing table, how do I want to move today?
Yeah.
How do I want to move my hand?
Yeah.
How do I want to move my arm? Right.
Yeah. Are you just going to move your bare two fingers?
You know, and that changes the look of what happens, you know, immensely. Right.
Yeah.
And then also the tool that you use, right? Thin brush or thick brush. I mean, how are the bristles on the end? Is it smooth or is it a gnarly rough brush? I mean, you know, that thing that right on the table there, right? I mean,
oh, okay.
This is me just using up ink that I didn't want to waste and
wash out on the drain.
Yeah, yeah. So all that kind of stuff, you know, and artists could continually learn new tricks and techniques for, you know, the rest of their life. There's just so many different ways to go about making art. It's ridiculous.
It's interesting. One of the things that kind of jumped to my head as you're talking about the champions thing is because Winnipeg is more kind of this working, I don't want to say working class, but working city, where Vancouver, it's like the industries are very different. And I feel like there's a lot of creative trade here.
Is that right? Creative what?
Sorry? Trade. Like
creative
trades, like skills, like
okay.
crafts. Yes. Not crafts as in crafting, but like as you know.
I don't know. There was, you know, a lot of immigrants came to Winnipeg early 1900s. You know, we got quite a mix.
Yeah.
But a lot of larger centers would have that as well. I know there was tons of printers here in the city, like tons, like it was a huge printing industry.
Yeah.
And it, I guess the jobs came from all over. I mean, like Friesen Still is a huge printer that prints
so
everybody.
Much.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always constantly surprised, you know, it's like publication from New York. Oh, it was printed here. And yeah. Yeah.
I think here in Windsor and Montreal are probably the three big print
right
areas, I think.
But as far as the trades, yeah, I never really thought about it, so I don't know.
I could just be way off base. I just could just be presumptively speaking.
Like I know that, you know, Winnipeg, you know, there's a phrase that's used, discount city, or, you know, there's, I don't think a lot of people, but you know, some people buy art, but it's not like a household thing.
Yeah.
You know, because it's you got to buy food and whatever else.
Heat.
Yeah. Snow shovels. So there's a huge art community, and it's a lot of different, you know, the film community, the dance community, the music community, the art community. I mean, the comics, a lot of comic artists here in the city that have done incredible things over the years. You know, Digital Chameleon was started, one of the earliest comic coloring outfits, you know, was
started here. Our mutual friend, Dave McKay.
Dave McKay, he worked there. I worked there very briefly. But yeah, started with, by Chris Chakri and Laverne Kandursky, you know, both comic colorists here. And then many other colorists continue to be coloring comics.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. It's, you know, we got George Freeman, you know, maybe the godfather of comic art in one sense, you know, with Captain Canuck.
Yeah.
Goes back to there, but he's done a lot of stuff over the years.
Yeah, I was talking to Nick Burns about him and how he is kind of, yeah, like you said, like the godfather, like the local, you know, figurehead that's not a figurehead, like just a mentor for a lot of people.
Yeah. A lot of people have sort of gone through his, won't be the word, not a studio. Well, I know Laverne worked under him for a while. I don't know if anyone else has worked under him, but he certainly has been around that the other comic artists know, you know, know him and certainly respect him for sure.
Tell me a bit about the alternative scene here in the 80s and 90s. Like, you were doing mini comics.
I was doing mini comics. I would run into Darren Marinick in the photocopy, at the photocopier, the Canon photocopier place. There was, I didn't really see a lot more. Like, there was, in the 80s, not so much that I was so familiar with. You know, mentioned Darren Marinick. You know, in the 90s, a little bit more, with the publication of Sunburn.
I was wondering about that. I've got a handful of issues somewhere.
Right. And he was, you know, so there was a lot of local artists there. And he expanded to getting some other art. You know, Billy Mavries was in some issues. But there was, you know, the comic shows before the huge pop comic shows that started to come out. And you know, I was always the different one there, it seemed. Like, there wasn't a lot of other alternative stuff, and it's just always on the fringe. What's that?
The alternative to alternative.
Yeah. even more extreme than say what the other guys were doing earlier on. But they weren't a lot of them sort of stopped doing comics. I don't really have much in that regard. I was also also such a very quiet person. And, you know, introverted and just so, you know, in my own little space for the most part, it was just hard for me to go to talk to people or to introduce myself or, you know, to say hello to somebody, you know? And so, you know, you don't meet as many people that way when you can't go outside of your shell, right?
Yeah.
But there was, So most of the alternative stuff that I was coming across or connected with would have been through Clay Gertie's newsletter, Comics Wave. And I would order, like, you know, you would just mail someone, or you'd trade, and, you know, you send someone a dollar and you'd get a, you know, comic or two back. And there was just various ones, you know, sporadically there that I would get and connect with, and occasionally be, you know, invited to put some comics or a page in someone else's little mini comic.
Yeah.
But I was just sort of, yeah, my comics sort of turned into novelty comics and, you know, continually put out. Like I was, as far as like comics proper goes, I got to get another book out. You want to maybe pause that for a sec? Anyways. I guess you could turn it back on and I could just...
I'll just edit out.
Okay. You can have this.
I was going to ask if there's anything I could buy off you.
You buy everything. Tons. Jeez. I mean. Okay. So through. Is it on? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Through the. It was neat when Sunburn came out because it allowed me to have something to, you know, work for. Not that I really, because I was doing, you know, always doing other stuff, you know, paintings and, you know, printmaking and, you know, comics was just an occasional thing. So this collection here is a collection of the Sunburn comics.
Okay.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Of what I was contributing to that magazine.
That's great.
And a couple of these are from my early mini comics.
Yeah.
Like here's the, yeah, Comics Wave Acid Man here.
The digest Britain. Size.
Yeah. Yeah, just sort of reformatted for the magazine. But yeah, most of them were originally made for Sunburn. So that was a great publication. I don't remember how many issues came out, but quite a few, really. A
couple dozen, I think, something like that.
Jeez,
yeah.
Was it that many?
Who was it that put that together?
Carl, oh geez, sorry, Carl, where are you? Carl,
Carl something.
Oh my goodness, but names at my age, names are doing that. They sort of evaporate if you don't use them enough. If you don't think about someone, you know, in a month's time, it's gone. It'll come back to me at another time, I'm sure, when I'm just falling asleep.
You'll jolt wide awake. Did you ever get into meditation?
Yes, it's difficult, but I do, and I still, you know, there's so many different ways that one can meditate, that I do it in sort of maybe quirky ways.
How do you ground yourself in your focus?
Breathing, usually, is sort of a breathing thing. I have to do that for some other medical reason, which I don't know if I want to get into that, but
life,
yeah.
I'll just say life.
But it's sort of maybe quirky to say, but you know, when I'm painting, when I'm doing art, I mean that's a huge form of meditation for me. You know, it's not meditation proper, but it is sort of this quietness, this flow, this...
Do you know mindfulness?
I think so. I don't know if I'd be able to give you a definition of it.
It sounds like you're describing something like that, where you're being in the actions you're doing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like you're being...
Yes. Walking and...
Yeah,
eat
conscious.
When eating.
Yeah,
yes,
and your
yes.
focus within that, and
yes.
and it's yeah, it's taking that time, it's slowing yourself down,
yes.
and finding a center through it. Yeah,
yeah. No, yeah. I'm constantly trying to do that. I have to, otherwise I'd be up in the clouds all the time, or you know, up in your head, and you know, thinking about this and that. And yeah, when, you know, it's difficult to just quiet your mind for sure, because you get this, those trains of thoughts, right, that just take you out of that. But there's this also, this other thing I used to do, and it's, again, it's a little bit more difficult now, but, and it's through breathing, and you could really get into some psychedelic experiences for sure.
Yeah.
You know, when you know, if your eyes closed, and you know, there's little sparkles and things that you see, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was able to, you know, out of that blackness to see the singular spark, to see this singular sparkle. But again, it's through certain breathing, and the other part of that breathing thing, which was pretty wild. Like one day, well, I was at one visit at the dentist. You know, you always get your mouth frozen, right? But this one time, this doctor gave me nitrous oxide, the dentist.
Yeah.
And I got so blasted, it was ridiculous. It was actually a bad trip.
Really?
It was a bad trip.
That's fascinating.
And I had a huge headache after.
But
it gave me information for later when I started using this technique of breathing through your nose. If you like, breathe as slow as you can through your nose, you know, breathe out, like take, you know, as long as you can to take that breath in, you know, you start to taste something. And when that happened, and I was like, what's that taste? What am I tasting here? It wasn't a smell, it was a taste. And I realized it's the same as nitrous oxide. And that, I mean, it's in the air. It's actually in the air. So when you're breathing through your nose very slowly, you're sort of straining that, sort of sifting that nitrous oxide out.
You're
and it starts to alter your mind.
You're activating the vagus nerve. I forget which nerve that helps with your did a whole bunch of stuff around my own kind of anxiety and stuff around different ways of tempering, and
heavy breathing
through the nose activates a specific nerve system within you to help balance yourself.
There you go. Yeah. See, I don't know that.
Yeah.
But it's just, see, there's a lot of things that I do that I just intuitively do.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, sometimes I don't know, you know, I don't know why I'm doing it, but these little things seem to work, or they do something. You know, I find that constantly sort of happens. I've had a lot of, there's a lot of little bizarre coincidences, you know, one might say. Like when I was framing that Neil Adams poster,
the
Batman poster.
The Joker holding up the card.
Yeah. I had that poster for like maybe 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And it went through, a couple moves. And, you know, on the recent move to here, it was like 5 years ago or so, you know, I thought, okay, I got to get this thing framed. I got to, you know, so I brought it up in here in the studio, which it remained for, you know, a few years in the tube. And it's like, okay, I got to get this thing framed, you know? So I finally get it out of the plastic tube and get to lay it flat because it's just so, you know, curvy. Right. And, laid it flat for a while. And finally go get a frame for it. Well, no, I think I got a frame. And then again, it was like, you know, months later, you know, finally get around to, okay, I'm going to, there was this evening that I was going to do it. But I fell asleep. And I saw, and then I woke up at like midnight. It's like, shit, I was going to finally frame this thing.
Yeah.
Get it done. So I'm going to do it anyways, you know, at midnight. And it was giving me hell. Like it was, and I gashed my finger on these back pins.
Oh yeah.
I ripped the poster a little bit as I was trying to get it in the frame, and it's like fucking. And
a lot of angry swearing.
I really gashed my finger, just sliced it. It was like as if there was like an X-Acto blade back there or something. Get it on the wall. The next day or a couple days later, I find out that he had just passed away.
Weird.
Like it was, he passed away
the
time that I was putting the poster in the frame.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's one of quite a number of odd little things that seems to happen.
The old Robert and Tom Wilson synchronicities.
You know. But I love it. I love it. It's like, because it continually happens.
Yeah.
So there's something going on there about, you know, just...
There's like a...
About being connected.
Some kind of cosmic connection, for lack of a better term.
The fast forward book.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, one morning, I was thinking, geez, what if, you know, like there's a clause in the contract that if the publisher goes out of business or they're getting rid of stock, they, you know, I'm allowed to buy copies or buy the inventory. Yeah. You know, buy the inventory, you know, before they get shredded or something, I get a chance to do that. And it's like, well, what would I do if I was presented with this option? And it's like, well, of course I'd buy some copies. I don't know how many I'd be able to buy, but yeah, I mean, you know,
yeah,
I don't want them to disappear. So that was in the morning. That afternoon, like, I, you know, I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, that's not going to happen for years. The book, you know, the books aren't old, you know, just been published. And so, you know, out of my mind. But that afternoon, I got an email from the publisher with that proposal. It's like, you know, I've got to get rid of some inventory here. And as per contract, you know, offering you, you know, if you want to get some copies. Yeah.
Funny.
It is.
Yeah.
Also with Fast Forward, I had like maybe 30 pages done. I was at TCAF and met Mark Tessier.
Okay.
Loved my work. He loved Fast Forward. And said, let me know when it's finished. And so I had done some more pages, and then I had like left it for, you know, I was about maybe like 70% done. Yeah. And I either ran out of steam or something, got involved in something else, and that whole flow was broken. Sort of like left it, you know, 6 months or three quarters of a year later, I'm thinking, geez, I gotta, you know, finish this thing. You know, it's sitting there, it's almost done. Let's just finish it.
Yeah.
So I spent a couple more weeks finishing that, and you know, there's a point, you know, you're finished, but you still have to kind of, you know, you got to go over things and whatnot. Yeah. But you know, you sort of say it's done. You know, you get to the point, it's finished. The next day, I got an email from Mark asking how it was coming. The next day.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, again, after all that time that had passed, right?
Ubiquitous timing.
Just happens to be
that
time. And and he was asking because he was, you know, on the board for Moal, and he wanted to present it to them as something, and thinking that the publisher would love it, and he did, and bang, it was so fast, it was so quick, it was bizarre. It was kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
How it just sort of happened. Yeah. Anyways, another one of those things. Like I said, that just happens.
Have you looked at any kind of contemporaneous work that's working in the same vein?
I'm curious because some neat French stuff happening.
There is. I was in Angoulême a few years ago. I picked up a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I could pull out cases and boxes of books. I mean, I don't know any names. I'm terrible with names. You know, I wish I could name a whole bunch of people, but I can't.
I'm more curious.
But they're...
Yeah. My curiosity is more like... one obvious one for me is maybe Le Grand Review and Sammy Stein and Alexis Beauclair, some folks that do.
Yes, so. Yes, see, Beauclair is a name that comes out. Yes, yeah.
And I'm wondering, as you've been kind of working in this way on your own here and then seeing this kind of similar wavelength work over there and kind of how you respond to that and how that informs you.
Respond by buying it and then not looking at it because I don't want to be influenced.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, to buy it, I look at it and then it gets like stashed away. Like there is a book, Abstract Comics that Fantagraphics published by, edited by Andre and Molitude.
Yeah.
Also Canadian.
Yeah.
But I think he doesn't like me now or something. I tried to get a hold of him to do a blurb for the book.
Oh, okay.
For Place Into Being. Because we were trying to get a hold of him. Nick and I were trying to get a hold of him and we didn't get a response. But anyways, I got a copy of this book, Abstract Comics, and it sort of mentions it, shows it in Place and Being as well. And it's like, holy F, man, this is like what I want to do.
Yeah.
I closed the book, I never looked at it again.
Yeah.
And then that's when I started doing the full pages of these.
Yeah.
And that was, 12, 14 years ago. About 2012-ish, 20 is when I started to do these. Yeah. And again, is when I got a day, it's an evening job, and I just, what do I want to do? You know, what kind of art do I want to do? And it was just, I got to do these comics. So the Place Into Being is a collection of part of the first 90. I started numbering all the comics. All my comics have a number, whether it's you know, a one page, two page, or five page, you know, comic or graphic novel has a number attached to it. A three panel comic will have a number to it. Okay.
Yeah.
There's like 860 860 comics.
A lot.
Since from that time, so that publication sort of just propelled me to make comics, because it is what I mean. It's not like my Acid Man comics weren't, you know, abstract. You know, a lot of people says, well, you were doing abstract comics already, you know, ages ago, you know. But you know, this sort of it was a different turn.
Yeah.
For me. It sort of gave me it's like it was okay to do it or something. You know.
It's interesting too, because some of this stuff is on the same wavelength of someone like Ron Rigi, but he was doing that kind of stuff later.
Right. Yeah. There's a second volume of this.
Yeah.
Which he's did the cover.
Yeah.
And I have some Acid Man stuff, some old Acid Man stuff.
Oh, in those. Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
I feel so really weird about it. And it's like, don't know what to do. But I got an email from, not an email, it was like an Instagram post from, I think, someone that knows Andre, but also Andre itself, just sort of accusing me of like copying, just outright copying. And it was like, I mean, it was hurtful. And it was also like, what are you talking about?
Also, he's not the artist of the book.
You know?
He's the editor.
Yeah, yeah. No, so, but he does art. He does comics as well, right? I mean, there's some, I know there's some in there.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of his stuff, you know, elsewhere. But it's like, there's so many other people. There are so many other people that are doing the same thing, yeah, you know, as well. So I touch upon it, but it's not like it's the only thing I do. I mean, maybe there's other artists thinking, oh, he's working just like me, or he's working just like me. You know, sometimes I don't know where things come from, but again, I'm not, you know, looking at their work and sort of thinking how I could, you know, do it like that.
Yeah.
You know.
You know what, though? Like, there's a, and I can't speak for Andre specifically, but there's a sometimes over-responsive sensitivity.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it's like, what I'm kind of thinking, okay, yeah, there's like maybe a similarity for sure. I mean, I think my work is similar to, you know, other people as well. But it's sort of what they're seeing is an extrapolation of what they possibly could have done.
Yeah.
If they continued or extrapolated, you know.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that, or they're not doing that, but you know, I did. All, you know, all artists do that. They extrapolate upon what they've seen, and you know, there's, you know, one of my favorite artists right now is Jim Mahfood.
Oh yeah.
And incredible stuff, but I see other artists that he's drawing from, or that he has drawn from.
And he will be, you know, the first to go, yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, got Ashley Wood, you got Jack Kirby, you've got
some Bill Sienkiewicz in there.
You know, I mean, you take bits and pieces and you turn it into something else.
The art's a conversation, yeah, right? Yeah. And it's, and that's why art keeps moving, because it keeps talking to each other.
Yeah. Neat. Yeah. Yeah.
Being in Winnipeg and someone that's kind of taking in visuals from other things and very much absorbing, tell me about Nutty Club.
Wow. I had a studio next door to the Nutty Club building. But even before that, I mean, it's just an institution of candy. I mean, just the way the candies are packaged in those clear bags
with, it's like a psychedelic Michelin,
you know, with the top,
with those wavy tops.
Yeah.
Wait, do I have,
Oh, don't worry.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know. Oh yeah. Just bag of popcorn. That's just bag of popcorn. But these little bags.
Yeah.
And they hit, you know, had these racks, all corner stores had them. So yeah, you'd be buying candy. You'd be buying candy from this place. And
candy man.
Yeah, that's the character there. But I had a studio next door in a building next door to the Nutty Club. People often thought I was in the Nutty Club.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know.
Give me time.
Figuratively, yeah. For like 20, 23, 24 years, I was like next door. There's two huge Nutty Club buildings in the Exchange. So I was next to one, and there was another one. I never really knew what was ever going on there, but that's where they made popcorn. And
It's like some kind of Willy Wonka.
It's a huge building. Yeah, huge buildings.
Yeah.
At one point, because I make candy.
Okay.
And because of the novelties, you know, I package the stuff that I made. I make a caramel, but I call them camels. So I have this whole Egyptian motif with this black pyramid, and they just look so, you know, rich and expensive, and people love them.
Yeah.
So actually, I went to the Nutty Club, and can you make these? They said, no, we can't make them here. But we know someone that would be able to. And if these people make them, they can make them. We'll distribute them. because they were a huge distributor for candy and also other novelty candies. I mean, when I was in their office, they just had these shelves just full of stuff they currently distribute or have distributed, and it's a lot of the novelty candies that are coming, which I have a ginormous collection of. Downstairs in the basement, I had been collecting. I've been collecting candy and wrappers for ages. Anyways, so I went to the manufacturer, the place that made candy. They were able to do it. It was within their realm, but they wouldn't be able to package it the way I wanted to package it. And that was a bit of a turnoff. I have to, you know, in any of my inventions, because there's other things that have happened in the past where I'm just so strict that it just blows the deal. It just doesn't, nothing happens. It's ridiculous. You know, I just got to bend a little, right? Then things would happen. It would have just, the packaging that they had and the way it would have cheapened it, like Halloween Kisses.
Yeah.
You know? And I wanted something a little bit more expensive, a little bit more regal, but I should have just, in hindsight, I should have just went down that route and just get it done, you know? But I didn't have money.
Yeah.
I went there, you know, before, you know, somewhat in desperation. It's like, I got to get a friggin' job. How can I make some money? And, would have...
Candy mogul.
Well, yeah, because there was other things. I've got these Pollocks, these Pollock lollipops. They look like Pollock paintings.
Oh, funny.
But they're like lollipops.
I notice you have a collection of cherry blossom candies.
I
have a friend in LA who uses it in a lot of his performance art.
Oh, really?
He's heartbroken.
What did he do?
He does a thing called the Canadian Romantic.
Okay.
And so he talks about them. Robert Dayton is his name. Oh, yeah.
That's what they looked like when I was a kid.
Let me get a photo of that for Robert.
That's the old and the recently present. The recent past. And the old, you got it?
Yeah, I'm just getting a little bit of the.
Do you want me to
window glare? Perfect. Okay.
I've eaten way more of these than I
should have.
Maybe, you know, I mean, they were never all at once, but I have a whole bunch of empty boxes for some stupid reason. I keep things. It's funny because when I found out that they were discontinued, it was already too late. Stores didn't have them anymore. It's like, fuck. Because the last one I had was maybe a month or two earlier. If I had known that was going to be the last one, I would have savored it. So I was like looking all over the place for them because I do love them. And it didn't happen, so I gave up. Jackie was on a road trip with her friend and she was in Clear Lake and there was a store there that had two of them.
Oh my God.
So this was already what, May or June or something?
Yeah.
And already some months later, you know. She only bought one because she didn't know how long it's been there. You know, thought maybe it's old. And it took me 3-4 weeks before I ate it because this was the last one.
Yeah.
You know, and it was glorious. It was nice. I did take photos, I was gonna post them, but I didn't because it just seemed too silly. But people post stupid, silly things all the time.
Oh, I post my cats.
I gotta learn to do that. Well, you mean not cats, but other things, you know, day-to-day stuff. But anyways, it's cherry blossoms.
Well, thank you for taking the time with me today, Robert.
That's it?
We've been past an hour. I've been chatting with Robert Pasternak, and his books are AM Comics.
Place into being. Fast forward and place into being. Meanwhile, and a bunch of other
things.
800 plus.
800 plus. I got to show you some novelties.
Yeah. And